was very disappointed that we couldn't get that work done today, knowing the workload that lies before the legislature.
A majority of lawmakers refused to consider more than 100 of Governor Bill Walker's appointments. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 27th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, President Trump is expected to use another executive order tomorrow, this one to undo Obama's ban on offshore Arctic oil leasing.
All of us should get worried about last-minute actions from any administration.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Governor Bill Walker tried and failed to get lawmakers to vote on his nominees today. 5 minutes after starting a joint session, the legislature voted along caucus lines, 32 to 26, to adjourn without holding a vote. Senate President Pete Kelly says he plans to hold votes on the nominees before the legislative session ends. The deadline to end the session is May 17th. Kelly says the legislature should focus on the budget and a plan to draw from the permanent fund to balance the budget. While some nominees have been controversial, Kelly denied that that was a factor in the delay.
There's nothing about this that has anything to do with any person. There's no one that I know of with a target on their back. I think there's some people that may have some difficulties. There's no question about that. But none of this has anything to do with any of the nominees.
Kelly and other Republican lawmakers have raised questions about Attorney General Jana Lindemuth, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission member Hollis French, and Human Rights Commission member Drew Phoenix. They and another 100 nominees will continue to act in their positions until either a vote or the end of the session. If there's no vote, all of the nominees must leave their positions. House Speaker Bryce Edgman says the legislature should act on the nominees and then move on to other business.
I was very disappointed that we couldn't get that work done today, knowing the workload that lies before the legislature.
Walker issued a proclamation on Wednesday calling the legislature into a joint session after the Senate twice turned down the House's invitation to meet. In a letter to Walker, Kelly called the proclamation an unproductive distraction. Of the legislators present at the session, every Senate majority and House minority member voted to adjourn, while every Senate minority and House majority member voted against adjournment. President Trump is expected to sign an order tomorrow aimed at lifting his predecessor's ban on oil leasing in waters off Alaska's Arctic coast. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke told reporters the new order will reverse Arctic withdrawals Barack Obama signed in the final weeks of his presidency.
Yeah, generally, I can tell you, all of us should get worried about last-minute actions from any administration.
Obama signed an order in December to permanently withdraw much of the Arctic and parts of the Atlantic from leasing. Environmentalists claim the section of law Obama used, known as 12A, doesn't allow for a reversal, so a lawsuit is almost inevitable. Zinke says Trump's order will also instruct him to review the 5-year offshore leasing plan. In November, President Obama eliminated the Arctic from that plan. Zinke says his review will take 2 years and the current plan will remain in effect for now. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
President Donald Trump signed an executive order yesterday to consider scaling back some national monuments. The plans likely won't affect Alaska, but the president still gave a shout out to the state in his speech. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Alaska has 5 national monuments, mostly designated by President Jimmy Carter under the Antiquities Act. It gives the president the authority to protect lands quickly. Trump's new directive asked the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to consider downsizing national monuments. It applies to those over 10,000 acres and created after 1996. That leaves Barack Obama's land designations, like the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, up for review. And at least in part, one in Alaska. The World War II Valor in the Pacific Monument extends from Hawaii and California all the way to the Aleutian Chain. But those islands in Alaska are also protected as a wildlife refuge. Still, Trump mentioned Alaska in his speech on Wednesday. He praised the splendor and the beauty of the country's natural resources and pointed to Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the Energy and Natural Resource Committee.
I can tell you the group that's in here right now, they're really doing the job. Right, Lisa? They're doing a good job? We're going to take care of Alaska, too. Don't worry about it.
Trump seemed to be referencing the executive order on reversing offshore drilling protections in the Arctic. He's expected to sign that on Friday. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Anchorage.
An Alaska marijuana retailer's tax payment has been sent back to the business after the U.S. Postal Service refused to ship the money. The Juneau Empire reported Wednesday that Rainforest Farms had tried to send a box full of cash to pay its taxes, but the post office says any proceeds from the selling of marijuana are considered drug proceeds under federal law. The farm had been trying to send its money to Anchorage. Alaska's tax director says the state needs to find a way for these legitimate business people to pay their taxes. One of the company's owners says being locked out of banks and marijuana being illegal federally makes running the business a challenge. He says most dealings are in cash. Rainforest Farms is Juneau's first legal marijuana retailer. Unionized pilots at Alaska Airlines and their recently acquired airline Virgin America pulled off a virtual barrel roll yesterday to get management's attention. The company complains that talks to combine both pilot groups under what they hope will be a more generous joint contract aren't moving fast enough. The Airline Pilots Association blasted out a statement during the middle of an Alaska Airline Group quarterly earnings conference call. CEO Brad Tilden came on the line to respond.
In the industry, and I think they're changing in Alaska with this merger, and things are moving fast, and so expectations are changing, and I think people are a little bit more on edge, and I think we're showing signs of that. That's what's going on right now.
Tilden said one thing that hasn't changed is the value his company places on a good working relationship with its labor unions. Tilden insisted the integration of Virgin America continues to progress well. The pilots' union and Alaska Airlines resume negotiations with the help of a mediator next month. Seattle-based Alaska Air Group reported solid earnings this week for the first quarter of 2017. Profits were lower compared to the same quarter a year ago because of higher fuel prices and costs related to its merger with Virgin America. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, spring has been fairly mild, but South Central will need more rain to dampen increasing pollen and mold counts.
Dry conditions, pollen and mold, they can just blow around more.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Apply at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Summer promises to be a busy construction season for the interior due to a series of projects at the region's two Air Force installations. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the projects will inject more than $1.5 billion into the area's economy.
Work is just getting underway on a $22 million building at Eielson Air Force Base. That'll enable pilots of the new F-35 fighters that are coming here to train in a computer-simulated environment.
We just broke ground on that, so that project's ongoing. We expect it to finish in about October of 18.
Kevin Blanchard directs the F-35 Program Integration Office for Eielson's 354th Fighter Wing.
We'll get our first aircraft in April of 2020. But to do that, we got to build a bunch of facilities.
About $510 million worth of facilities will be built over the next couple of years to accommodate the two squadrons of F-35As that'll be based at Eielson. Blanchard says Eielson has opened its south gate to give workers easy access to their construction sites on that end of the base.
We have a very congested front gate at certain times of the day as right now. So our ability to use that, the south gate, as a contractor/construction gate just during the time period of the F-35 buildup will alleviate a lot of that congestion and traffic.
State Transportation Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says a project to improve the south gate intersection with the Richardson Highway will get underway later this year.
There will be some installation of the overhead lighting, some signing, striping, and then constructing a north and southbound turn lanes on the Eielson, and then there will be a northbound acceleration lane.
Blanchard says seven projects are scheduled to get underway this year on Eielson in support of the F-35s, including one for $9.4 million to build six munitions storage bunkers, and another estimated to cost between $40 and $50 million to construct a maintenance hangar.
That involves all the people that are coming with the airplanes that will fly them, fix them, support them, that type of thing.
About 1,250 people are coming to Eielson to fly, fix, and support the F-35s, nearly all of them active duty personnel. Blanchard says that number could grow to about 1,370. He says Lockheed, the aircraft manufacturer, will bring about 60 workers, and subcontractor Pratt & Whitney, which builds the jet's engines, another half dozen. And he says most of the newcomers will bring family.
Expecting about 60% of those folks to have families. So the total number that we're looking at as far as coming into the community will be about 3,500.
But Eielson doesn't have anywhere near enough on-base housing to accommodate all those newcomers, says Jim Dodson, president and CEO of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation.
So 70% of them are going to have to live off-base.
Dodson says the newcomers will need another 800 units of housing, and he says building them will pump another $80 to $100 million into the local economy. He says Eielson's projects, combined with the construction of a new radar facility at Clear Air Force Station just south of Nenana, are giving the area's construction industry a badly needed boost.
That whole project, including the long-range discrimination radar and the buildup of that base, that's about $1 billion worth of construction.
Dodson says the economic boost from both military-related construction and the growing workforce it'll bring will go a long way toward alleviating the recession that's set in statewide since oil prices began to plummet 4 years ago. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
In Unalaska, the U.S. Coast Guard has cleaned up controversial graffiti that was found spray-painted on a World War II bunker last month. The slogan read, #722LifeMorganThugs, which led many Unalaskans to suspect crew members of the Coast Guard cutter Morgenthau. The vessel was recently decommissioned after nearly 50 years of service, so the crew of another cutter, the Mellon, was assigned to cleanup duty last week.
You know, it wouldn't scrub off, so we painted it in a color that was similar to the bunker. So you can't really tell. You might notice if you saw it before, but it looks pretty good.
Lieutenant Brian Dykens is a Coast Guard spokesperson in Juneau. He says the crew got permission from the landowning Unalashka Corporation before painting over the tag.
We have a rich history with Dutch Harbor and Unalashka, so it's important to us to kind of remain part of that community, and we wanted to clean up any damage that we may have caused.
The Coast Guard hasn't accepted full responsibility for the graffiti yet. Dykin says that's because the matter is still under investigation.
We're just going to try to track down who did it and why and maybe learn from this incident, because we do know there's some bunkers there that Coast Guard members do tag and some others that we can't. So we want to make sure everyone's clear on what we can and cannot do there.
Dykin says he's not sure when the investigation will end or if it'll produce any conclusive findings. Now that the Morgenthau has been retired, he says Unalaskans can expect to see the Mellon in port more often, along with the Berthoff and other West Coast cutters. These newer vessels have taken over the Coast Guard's patrol of the Bering Sea. Starting next year, the Lake and Peninsula School District will have a shorter calendar. Officials say the new schedule is based on subsistence activities. Students will go back to school in early September instead of August and be finished by early May instead of close to June. It should also help the district balance the projected $500,000 deficit caused by shrinking revenues from the state. KDLG's Lawrence Hamilton has more on what's being called the subsistence school calendar.
Under the new schedule, the school year opens on September 5th and finishes on May 1st, a reduction of 20 days. While other districts have tried four-day school weeks and other budget-cutting measures, Lake and Penn is the first school district in the state to try reducing the number of days on the calendar.
Our villagers like this. It respects their culture. It respects their subsistence.
That was Lake and Penn Superintendent Ty Mace. He says the new calendar is a response to the district operating under a $586,000 deficit, a problem with no easy fix.
So basically, it's a creative cut. Instead of running a stripped-down, ineffective school system for a number of mandated days, we've asked the commissioner and the Department of Education if we can more efficient cut the fluff out of our instructional days, basically reduce our school year.
While this subsistence calendar would create more hunting and fishing opportunities, students would be expected to work harder through the school year. It will reduce the number of in-service days, professional days, and could potentially limit the number of out-of-school field trip opportunities.
It's tough to get your kids back in August. There's berry picking, there's the state fair, there's commercial fishing still going. You know, in May, this time of year, with the increased daylight, the migratory bird state testing over, we just find that the intensity starts to drop. And that's what we're really looking at here, is reducing our school year by upping our intensity.
The new calendar will result in 77.5 hours less of instructional time, but should trim the budget between $400,000 and $500,000. Those savings will come from a reduction of salaries for certified, classified, and administrative staff. Other savings will be found in reducing student and staff transport, food service, utilities, and general maintenance. The subsistence calendar is really a return to how schools used to be run, says Lake and Penn Borough Mayor Glenn Allsworth Sr. He thinks Lake and Penn could actually get some money out of the idea.
Oh no, I suggested to Ty Meese, the superintendent, that he franchises ideas so every other district that falls in on that, we get a percentage of what they save, because it's going to be effective.
Ed Lester is the principal at the New Haven School and feels the staff can handle the more intense workload.
It's just going to be one of those things that we're going to have to be very focused on the education and focused on where we're putting our time and our energy and our effort. And it's got to be in the students.
Educators in the district understand the concerns about a reduced amount of time in the classroom, but feel the calendar will benefit teachers who won't have to play catch-up with students who missed the first few weeks of school anyway. Emily Mulcahy teaches English and Social Studies at Non-Dalton School.
In reality, this is a really good move for LPSD. It gives those kids those 3 weeks to fish, to subsistence fish for their family, to commercial fish and make money, whatever they're doing, it gives them that time. And I think that our kids work really hard once they're in their seats. But if they're not in their seats, they're not learning.
The superintendent feels the calendar's success will be judged by the students' results.
You know, the real measuring stick is going to be student achievement. If we can't hold our student achievement, we're going to have to take a tough look at this and decide whether we want to continue on or not.
The calendar has been approved by the Alaska Department of Education and the Lake and Penn School Board and will go into effect this upcoming school year. Other districts are watching Lake and Penn's bold experiment, and time will tell if this subsistence school calendar is a workable model for a rural education. In Dillingham, I'm Lawrence Hamilton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A number of Haines residents make a living with location-neutral jobs. So in January, when Alaska Power and Telephone rolled out new internet packages following its Lynn Canal fiber optic project, the internet-reliant workers were paying attention. KHNS's Emily Files checked in with some of them and has this report.
I'm Gene Cornelius in Haines, Alaska.
And we are at your home office, would you say?
I would call this a home office, absolutely. That's my kitchen table, but there's no kitchen involved. It's covered with gear.
Cornelius is a stock footage videographer. He films everything from sunsets to trucks driving by and hopes someone creating an advertisement or documentary will pay a few hundred bucks to use his clips.
What'd you just type in?
Slow motion eagle. This was a lucky shot. In Homer, there is an eagle sitting on a dumpster.
You don't see the dumpster in the clip, just the eagle. It looks to the camera and then flies away in slow motion.
This particular clip has sold 39 times.
For every clip like this that sells well, there are a lot that no one buys. That's why, for stock videographers, quantity is important.
You have to constantly be putting more media up. It's called feeding the beast.
And that has been one of Cornelius's biggest challenges in Haines. Uploading video from the camera to the computer takes time with any internet connection. But here, upload speeds are more limited. When Cornelius heard AP&T's newly installed fiber optic cable would improve internet packages in the Upper Lynn Canal, he had high hopes. Then the company announced the details.
I was a little bit livid.
The new offerings significantly increased data caps and download speeds, but upload speeds stayed the same at 1 megabit. Cornelius says it does make sense that they focused on download speeds because that's what most people use internet for, streaming video, not uploading it.
We are a society of consumers. I mean, here I am making media, but I also consume it.
Cornelius was upset at first, but he says AP&T has been working with him. Later this year, they're going to install a new modem at his home that he says should double his upload speeds. While Cornelius wasn't thrilled with the new offerings, other internet-reliant workers in Haines have been satisfied.
It was just a breath of fresh air for us.
Andrew Del Preti is a web developer who works for a Texas-based company. His job is somewhat related to what Cornelius does. Del Preti works on websites that host stock music and video. Del Preti says with his old internet package, the data cap was an issue.
And so I was going over my internet cap every month. We had the highest plan of like 8 megs down, 1 meg up at 80 gigs a month. And we were pretty much going over that every time. And so that really kind of put a burden on finances and also just, you know, didn't allow the kids to watch Netflix or for us to do extracurricular stuff, you know, on the internet other than me working.
When AP&T rolled out new packages in January, Del Preti's speeds tripled and the data cap increased exponentially. Now he's able to video conference with his colleagues in Texas without worrying.
You know, I think having faster and more reliable internet will be able to bring a different type of person here that might not be able to make it doing kind of the traditional things, which I think is great as well, and I hope that continues to grow. But I think that having this is another way of bringing people in.
Attracting more location-neutral workers like Albaro, Del Preti, and Cornelius to Haines is one of the goals listed in the borough's comprehensive plan. With better internet, that aspiration may be closer to reality. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Allergy and asthma sufferers, beware. The pollen and mold season is upon us. There are only 2 spore collection sites in the state, Fairbanks and Anchorage, and the instruments were activated this week. The University of Alaska and the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center run the monitoring program. Stacey Cooper is a health assessor at the Environmental Health Program for the State Health Department. She told Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend, spore traps capture pollen and mold for 24 hours and deposit it on a slide.
The pollen counters look at that slide through a microscope, and they're trained to be able to count how many tree pollen and how many grass, how many weeds, and they can report how much of each type of pollen or mold is out there over that course of 24 hours. So it's a snapshot.
We had a winter that was closer to normal this year, a lot more snow and colder temperatures than the previous few years. But now, at least in South Central, it's getting a bit dry. We haven't had much rain. How does a drier spring impact pollen and mold?
Typically, drier conditions will lead to higher mold counts just because in dry conditions, pollen and mold, they can just blow around more. With a winter like we just had, where it was cold and there was a lot of snow, sometimes, you know, that can make the trees pollinate more because they're good conditions over the winter for it to be cold with a lot of snowpack. So with a winter like we just had, you might see the peak of trees be a little bit later in May than the last couple of years where we've had these really mild winters. But you're right, the dry conditions actually could lead to us seeing pollen as we're seeing it now. You know, the pollen has started, it's low, but if it continues to be dry, then the peak could be a little bit earlier. It's really hard to know. There's so many factors that go into it.
What can people do to protect themselves if they have allergies or are irritated in a significant way by both pollen and mold?
Well, you know, there's several things that people can do. On a day where they feel like they're suffering or that the mold counts or the pollen counts are reported as high, they can limit their outdoor activities as much as they can. If they do need to go outside, pollen counts, the pollen levels are usually highest in the mornings. So maybe just stay inside in the mornings when the pollen is the highest. Other things they can do is they can keep their windows closed and use a HEPA filter. And these are filters that clean the air of mold and pollen. If people feel that those types of precautions aren't really helping, they should see their provider and maybe look into getting some allergy medicine that could help. And for people who already have allergy medicine, it's best to start taking it before they start suffering in the season.
Stacey Cooper is a health assessor with the state's health department. She spoke with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend. Pollen from trees, grasses, and weeds can be bothersome through August. Mold can continue to be an irritant through September. A link to the monitoring page is at our website, alaskapublic.org. The Native Youth Olympic Games are underway. That's the Inupiat translation of the Star Spangled Banner sung by kids from the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School at today's opening ceremonies in Anchorage. About 500 student athletes are in the city from more than 100 Alaska communities. After months of practice, the NYO Games are the state championships for events like the seal hop, the wrist carry, and the high kick. Marjorie Tabone is a former athlete and coach and now volunteers at the games.
All of these games have a significant purpose, and all of the purposes have to do with survival. All of the games were meant to test your abilities and skills and also prepare you for being out on the ice or being out on the land and hunting and just for survival in general.
The athletes say they appreciate the cultural significance of the games, but they're also in Anchorage to have fun and make new friends. That includes Palmer 7th grader Mia Weiss, who's competing in the wrist carry. It's an event that taught Weiss she has a special ability.
Because I'm really short. It's like NYO is different from any sport. It's really cool because if you're different sizes, you can pretty much find an event that fits you.
The Native Youth Olympics continue through Saturday. Admission and parking are free. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Lori Townsend, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Files in Haines, Lawrence Hamilton in Dillingham, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Tom Bancy in Oregon. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. Lori Townsend is our news director. And I'm Ann Hellman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.